Ah, children. It's Reverend Billy from the Church of Life After Shopping, WXOJLP. 103.3 FM, streaming online at www.valleyfreeradio.org. Amen.
Take a moment and see if you can guess what I'm doing. I'm getting healthy by walking. Walking daily has tons of health benefits, managing weight, lowering cholesterol and blood pressure, and improving your overall mood. So, whether it's around your neighborhood or over your lunch break, just take a walk. For your free booklet, visit wrinstitute.org or call toll-free 877-957-7575 and find us on Facebook and Twitter. The Will Rogers Institute, since 1936.
I'm Rachel Maddow with the Pioneer Valley Planning Commission and the Franklin Regional Council of Governments for Valley Free Radio, reminding you that legally, bicycles are vehicles and bicyclists have the same rights and responsibilities and should observe the same rules as motorists. For more information on bicycle rights and safety, go to www.massbike.org.
Bicycle, bicycle, bicycle. I want to ride my bicycle.
This is Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. With me in the studio today is also Dwayne Rainey.
Hello.
How'd you get here today, Dwayne?
By bike.
Imagine that. Today's topic is bicycles. It's a very broad topic. But anyway, especially for a short hour. But I've got lots of clips from mostly local bicyclists, and also interviews with Eli Damon, Francis Crow, and Colby Singleton, and some of my own comments about space and public and private space and motor vehicles. I started off by asking people why they ride a bike.
Right. I like it because I get good gas mileage. Very good gas mileage.
So the reason I'm on a bike is because I have a beautiful 4-month-old daughter who I've been with all day and after working all week, and I'm just trying to get some exercise because I know I have to stay healthy because I really want to be able to take care of her because she's so great.
I'm not a good car driver.
Any other things from your life in general that contributed to your riding a bike?
Well, not being allowed to drive a motor vehicle in any state in probably the world. So it's either walk or take public transportation or ride a bike. And so with all the bike trails, and I like the bike paths because I don't have to be in traffic and it's much more peaceful. And so for about 30 years I've been riding bikes.
What does it take to lose your driver's license in Massachusetts?
Not much. For me in particular, it was just a crazy summer when I was younger and I got 3 DUIs in 3 weeks. So, yeah, that pretty much contributed to me not driving ever again.
If you wanted to get a driver's license again, could you or would you?
Could I? Possibly. Would I? Probably not. Just for the cost of the motor vehicles and the gas and it's just a major expense that I really don't want.
Do you have anything, Dwayne, you'd like to add to that interview since you're now here live?
It's a beautiful day to ride a bike.
And in Springfield, people think I'm nuts for riding a bike. I tell them I go grocery shopping with the trailer and I fill it up and ride it home, and they're like, what? I feel proud of myself, you know? I'm like, wow. People think you're poor if you ride a bike because they feel like you can't afford something better. Mm-hmm. But to me, it's like, it's a choice. It's a lifestyle choice. And when I get home with all of my groceries and I unload them, and I just feel like I've done something.
How did you start riding a bike to work?
I lived 2 miles from the first place I got a real job on the books, which is a Waffle House. I got tired of walking and begging people to pick me up. So, I got tired of walking. And a bike if you've ever had to walk anywhere and then compared it to biking, like on a long-term scale, biking is just so much better than walking. Like, it feels better. You get some exercise, whereas walking, you just feel like, why am I doing this? I'm in purgatory or something. So I found like one of the ones that they sell at Target for like $300 on Craigslist for like $150. And that's it. I've been riding that thing for like a year and a half.
How has it changed your perspective?
I feel like my friend Spencer Madsen just said recently in an interview that, because he lives in New York City and he rides his bike everywhere, but he has such a dedication to it. Like, most people in New York City who bike around, they'll get on the train at some point. Like, if it's 35 degrees outside, they're going to get on the train, right? But Spencer does not do it. And he was talking about his militant stance on biking and how, like, he doesn't want to give the MTA any of his money. And I was just like, man, that's exactly how I feel, but I didn't know how to articulate it. So now I'm kind of reassessing my life, because that was recently. And here in Texas, everything is so far away. So far away. Even if you live in the city, like, there might not be all the things that you need on a day-to-day basis within a two-mile radius, which to me is like a bikeable radius. I'm rethinking my life. I don't have a driver's license at the age of 22 because I don't want one. I'd rather ride a bike. It's more fun. It feels good. And you look cool if you're doing it right. I don't know. We're worried about climate change. You've got people screaming and yelling one side or the other, but how are you going to make a change if you don't start with yourself? So start with yourself. Reuse things and ride a freaking bike.
That guy was from Texas, but most of these interviews are from Northampton.
Well, I hate driving. I find it boring and tedious. I don't like cars particularly. And I'm tired of the word empowerment, but there's something about being able to provide my own transportation and haul things around and also use public transportation with a bike that's very, very appealing to me. So I've been doing it for, I don't know, 30 years maybe. And actually one of my favorite experiences was borrowing a Pedal People trailer and moving a 6-foot bookcase by myself on the trailer from one apartment to another. I can't think of any aha moments. I could just think of many years of just really enjoying being on a bike and being able to see things on the road that you don't notice even when you're a passenger in a car because you're going too quickly.
That was Michelle Springmore, and the background music, I'm not sure who that was, but someone that plays on the street in Northampton on a Friday or Saturday night. The next interview I have is a 6.5-minute clip with Eli Damon.
Eli, what are some things in your life that contributed to your riding a bicycle today?
Yeah, it's actually a kind of dramatic story. I was born blind, not totally blind, but blind enough that I'm considered disabled. It caused some problems for me. And the main one is that I was, you know, I'm not allowed to drive a car. And I always thought of that as a very serious problem. I was very isolated most of my life because of mobility problems. I rode my bike a little bit. I took the bus. I walked. I begged rides from friends and family members with cars, but I didn't really have much of a life. I wasn't really able to pursue things, to have much of a social life or anything like that. And then in 2005, I had just broken up with the woman who is now my ex-wife, and I needed a way to get to my choir practice, which was pretty much the most important part of my social life at the time. And it would have been a really terrible thing if I had to give that up, and I couldn't figure out how to do it. And then I remembered that before we were even married, the woman who is now my ex-wife bought me this book called Effective Cycling, and by John Forrester. Although if you're looking for a source of this information. I don't recommend that book. It's not the greatest book, but it happened to be what I found. She had bought this for me because she didn't really know anything about cycling, but she said, you know, Eli rides a bike, and here's a book that I found, and I'll get it for him. So I dug out this book. I hadn't bothered to read it. She had bought it for me years before, and it just stayed in a box somewhere. But then I remembered it as I was trying to figure out how it was going to keep going to choir practice. And I started what it told me was a really, really incredible thing. Because before, I thought of biking as just this very limited thing. I only felt comfortable going short distances on very familiar routes. The routes had to have very special properties and, like, you know, small, low-traffic roads that I felt comfortable on. And even so, like, it was a stressful thing. I had a lot of crashes, even though I thought I was being very careful. And so I started reading this book, Effective Cycling, and it was telling me that if I just follow the same rules as other drivers, that I could use the entire road network with the same flexibility and the same predictability as motorists use it, and I could just go anywhere I wanted to, and I wouldn't have to worry about all the things that I was worrying about. And this just seemed so incredible to me. I was kind of skeptical because it seemed very scary, the idea that I should move away from the edge of the road and that I could go on busy multi-lane highways and stuff. But I kind of tried it out just very gradually, just on a road that I was familiar with, just moved a little farther away from the edge and just to see what happened. And sure enough, like, things got better instantly. I could see the way motorists were interacting with me changed, and I tried it a little more and a little more, and I tried on roads that were a little scarier and a little scarier, and pretty soon I felt I had mastered it, that I really could go anywhere I wanted to, and it changed my entire outlook on life. It changed everything that I thought that I could do and that I could be as a blind person.
So how did you get to choir practice? Where were you going from and to? And what was that first ride to choir practice like?
I lived in Amherst, and I was going to choir practice in Holyoke. And before that, the farthest I had gone south in Amherst was to Atkins Farm. And this would mean that I'd have to go over the notch. And it would also mean that which I had never done before, I'd have to ride through South Hadley and Holyoke, which is a more busier urban environment, which is something I hadn't experienced before. And so the first time, it was really kind of an adventure. It was very tough making it over the notch. I had never done a more physically strenuous kind of bike ride than that. And then I also had to find my way on roads that I had never seen before. But it all worked. All the things that I had learned from this book, they all worked, and I didn't have a problem. Nothing really scary happened. I didn't think I was going to get hit by a car or lost and stranded or anything like that. And of course, when I finally got there, I found out that I made a mistake, and we didn't actually have choir practice that week. But the value of the experience wasn't affected by that.
Mm-hmm. How is it biking in the dark?
There are some more challenges to riding in the dark. I mean, for one thing, you can't see the road surface as well. You can't see landmarks as well, so it's harder to navigate. Headlights can, oncoming traffic can blind you. But it's all things that I've learned how to deal with. So it doesn't stop me from doing it. And also, riding at night can be very peaceful. There's not much traffic. There's not, you know, you get to sort of experience the darkness. It can be really nice sometimes. Mm-hmm. There's a new program that I discovered called Cycling Savvy, even better training program that I learned even more from. And I also became an instructor for that, and I developed relationships with the founders and the other instructors that have been really great.
What's one of your favorite things about riding your bike?
I'm a very practically minded person, and so my favorite thing about riding my bike is what I can accomplish. I really enjoy a day where I have six errands to do and I can go around to six different places and come back afterwards and say I accomplished all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. That was Eli Damon. Eli received the 2014 Bike Advocate of the Year Award from Mass Bike Pioneer Valley. And you can contact him about bike classes through the Cycling Savvy website. Or if you're looking for any like good information about how to become a safe cyclist, Cycling Savvy is really helpful. It's cyclingsavvy.org. So this spring, I took trains and buses to Mexico City, and I biked around with women from Biciandia, a bike messenger cooperative there. Here's one of the cooperative members talking.
My name is Ale Medina, Alejandra Medina.
Gabriela says that you do alley cat races as well. What are those?
Oh, it's a crazy thing. It's like you are very late from a delivery and you have to do many, many checkpoints the faster than you can with no accidents, with no falling. It's very like a shot of adrenaline.
And you play bike polo?
I started to practice two years ago, one time in a torneo, and I was like, oh, qué divertido. But in January of this year, I took it again, and I was, whoa, this is great. It's like playing with a ball, a little ball, and like you are like a little child, but with your bike, with your team, with other girls, and you make strategies for make an annotation in your bike.
When you had a broken hand back in the fall and you were biking one-handed, were you playing polo too?
It's difficult to play because I need to change the brake because I'm right-handed, and it was difficult to see if the brake is in the right, I can take the mallet, no? With one hand is very difficult. It's a guy that play with one leg, with a ferula, with gesso. And he do it very well.
That's amazing.
So Ale talking about having the broken hand reminds me that biking doesn't work for everybody all the time. Here's my coworker, Sam.
I think the last thing I was thinking is, you know, I fell and hit my knees, and I have the privilege of having a car, and that's made it possible for me to do things that I can't walk very far right now. So if I need to get something at the store or just need to be somewhere, like go to a doctor's appointment, I can move a little bit more easily. So I think about cars and mobility differently right now that I'm injured. And I know for me that's probably going to be temporary, but for some people that's not. So what could a car offer somebody in terms of being able to get around physically in ways that might not otherwise be possible?
Yeah.
And how could we adapt a bike to make that broader? Well, has it already been?
Well, I actually had a conversation yesterday with this woman, Elizabeth, who hurt her knee. She's an older woman, and she hurt her leg, and she couldn't bend it. And she talked with All Out Adventures, and they hooked her up with a hand cycle, and she was able to move around on her own power. She said she needed a cooler to lift herself up and out of the bike, or to get in the bike, to like set her leg on her body. Uh-huh. On. I couldn't quite follow that. But there are options available, but again, the logistics of that are going to be really hard. Where are you going to keep it?
Yeah.
Where are you going to ride it on certain streets? It's fine on the bike path, but on other streets, it gets to be a little more awkward unless you're really confident in your abilities and your belonging.
I want to take this opportunity to give a shout out to All Out Adventures. They have a little office on State Street near the corner of State and Thin, and they have very nice people and all kinds of equipment for adaptive cycling. You've been listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Next up is Francis Crowe.
Your first bike ride, what do you remember?
There's a sense of freedom, I think, that you get when you're on a bicycle that, you know, you don't get if you're riding in a wagon or in a car.
Uh-huh. How old were you?
I was 13, And my parents were very cautious. They didn't think we really, girls, should have a bicycle. They thought there were too many cars in Carthage, Missouri. Uh-huh. And I kept really focusing on that I wanted a bicycle, nothing else. So my 13th birthday, they gave me a bicycle.
Uh-huh.
And I went out in the back. There was kind of an alleyway in back of the houses then. And where, you know, people could pick up trash, because mm-hmm. the streets were sidewalks and for walkers chiefly, and a few cars. There weren't that many cars. Mm-hmm. But I went up and down the alleyway. My father would run beside me, and they didn't have training wheels to help me. But uh-huh. very quickly, I learned to balance, and uh-huh. so I was off. And I rode my bicycle to high school, and that was, you know, something no one else did.
Not girls nor boys?
No girls nor boys rode bicycles. And I would ride it down, and I remember one of the first things, my bicycle got, the wheel got caught in the trolley tracks, and I flew off the bicycle. And everybody laughed, and they just thought it was hilarious, all the boys standing out in front. And so after that, my father said, why didn't I ride my bicycle down and park it at his store? He ran a plumbing and heating business and a flower store. They were two parts of the same store. One side was the flower store and the other side was the plumbing and heating. And he said, you can leave your bicycle here. And then, you know, you won't be trying to get it through the trolley tracks.
Uh-huh. So you could park there and then walk the rest of the way to school?
And the high school was just about a block away.
Uh-huh. So then did you start doing that? Or
I did that, yes. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So, you know, slowly they gave me more. My parents realized that I could do things, and they gave me more opportunities to do that. But I think, you know, there's something wonderful about bicycles because they give you so much independence. And when I moved to Northampton, 1951, I had a bicycle, and I rode all over town. And I remember I could go up Bedford Terrace, you know, and we didn't
that's a steep hill.
And we didn't have gears on the bicycles then. I could stand up and pedal all the way up the hill. And now, you know, I go panting, pulling my shopping cart.
That was Frances Crowe. Now we have this song called Op Fietsen by a Dutch band called Skik. Oh, by the way, I don't know what the words are, but it's all about having a great bike ride.
Ik ga fietsen door het duurzaam en op zo'n paard tussen slien en hem. En als ik dadelijk in mijn dip moet ben, dan fiets ik door. Dan zeggen we samen vaak of in orde aan. Bij Amsterdam met alle Donners kanaal. En als ik dadelijk dan de kaars moet zoeken, dan fiets ik door. Want ik wil alweer, ik wil alles zien. De laatste mooie dag van het jaar misschien. Alhoewel het met de winter dan donders mooi kan wezen. Ik wil alweer, de deur naar bij de vriend. Wat achterop het veld, dan maak ik graag weer. Aankje zo vliezen en dan ben ik niet slim. Dan giet het als vanzelf. Wie dat mij was, wie dat mij was. Wie dat mij was vandaag. Ik heb de band vol met vins. Die ik heb, ja, niks te klagen. Wie dat mij was, wie dat mij was. Wat vandaag, ik zal al zeggen, ja, het mag wel zo. Ik had de fietsen door het duurzaam en op zo'n paard langs de Duitse grens. Ik denk dadelijk in de kiep, ga in Duitsland. Gebben over op mijn schoeningsdorf. Ik sta hier te kijken bij een nieuw. En ik sta hier in mijn denk, wat zou ik nou doen, links of rechter? Want ik wil alweer, dan hebben we meer. Ik kan het hek niet nodig, want ik ken het hier.
Maak de dadelijk over schoon, ik ga de bank weer terug in Nederland. Ik wil al liever naar een baan gepaard. Ga ik zien of ik Noord en het Oost is een bas. Aak is hoofd vies en de bank niet sneeuw. Dan ging het als vanzelf. Wie dat mij waard, wie dat mij waard. Wie dat mij waard vandaag. Ik heb de banden vol met fans. Nee, ik heb ja niks te klagen. Wie dat mij waard, wie dat mij waard. Wie dat mij waard vandaag. Ik zal al zeggen, ja, het mag wel zo.
That was Skik with Optietze. You're listening to Valley Free Radio. This is Out There. Your host, Ruthie Woodring. Dwayne Rainey is also here in the studio with me.
In person.
Thanks for coming in, Dwayne.
My pleasure.
So something I think about a lot when I'm biking is how much space motor vehicles take up. And they take up space that, in many cases, it used to be a public space. If you look at a picture of New York City from, say, 150 years ago, you'll see many users in the street, people walking, pushing wheelbarrows, animals, people cleaning up after animals, people selling things. But now it seems like the streets are viewed as thoroughfares, just a piece of pavement primarily for fast-moving vehicles. And I noticed that as a cyclist, it's easy to fall into that same thinking trap when I'm on the rail trail, seeing the rail trail as the thoroughfare when it's really a multi-use path for all different kinds of people and animals. Much of the space in cities that's dedicated to automobiles, it isn't even for their movement. It's just to store them while they're still. And in a lot of cases, it's not even to store them. It's just to have the capacity to store them. Like there's zoning codes, ordinances that say that buildings have to have a certain number of parking spaces per square foot or whatever. It depends on the type of building, whether it's residential or commercial, things like that. I think I read once that some of the big box stores in some places, they have to have enough parking spaces to hold all the cars that might be there on the Friday after Thanksgiving. There is a University of Connecticut research team that published a study recently about how increased area for car parking leads to decreased land available for people, which leads to more commuting by car and fewer people living in cities. It's also a contributor to cities getting taller and taller because to provide a place for the people to be. It also contributes to a less friendly walking environment. Some of the cities they studied were Hartford and New Haven and Cambridge. Cambridge actually adopted parking limits lower than the minimum in some cities today, and it's led to a more pedestrian-friendly town. Downtown Florence is something that I notice a lot, the huge amount of lands that are paved over for parking lots. Like, look at the parking lots you have to cross to get from the rail trail to Main Street, like between Chestnut and Bardwell. If you look at a satellite image of it, it gives you a good idea of just how much pavement is there. I also think a lot about how highways and roads take public space and make it essentially private. You can park a private motor vehicle in a public parking space and then essentially have your own private room there to do whatever you want. And the bigger your car, the bigger your room, and the less space available for others. There's been a movement or kind of like an action thing. I don't know when it started, maybe like 8 or 10 years ago, called Parking Day. It's usually around September 20th or 22nd. And the idea is that you take over a parking spot or some parking spaces and you pay the meter and you put in benches, plants. Once we did it in Northampton on Main Street and we did free bike repair there. But just a way of reclaiming the space and giving life to it. Unfortunately, I think by most ordinances, that's kind of illegal. Like, I think car parking spaces are just for cars to park in. You're not able to do productive activity there, what in my mind I would call productive.
That is such a shame.
So sometimes I like to try and imagine an area, like in my neighborhood or downtown, as if I had x-ray vision and I could see through all the cars, all the buildings, and I could just see the human beings there. And then I think that sort of gives a better sense of how much space is dedicated to the structures that we enclose ourselves in. Here is one of my coworkers, Ben. Hope it's okay that I play this, Ben.
We were driving somewhere yesterday, and we passed Kristen on her bike, and then Molly on her bike, and I was like thinking how when you're on your bike around here, because most people drive, you're in the public space, so like everyone recognizes you and knows. Well, like Chris has stopped and was like digging through a free pile, so we were like, oh, look at Chris digging through a free pile. We were driving by in Claire's car, and we were like totally anonymous. You know, there's more cars, but then also you're like enclosed, so you're like in this anonymous space, just kind of like viewing out on the world of what people are doing. So it just seemed like a weird thing, because I was realizing that I'm usually on my bike, so yeah. People are like, oh, there's Ben. Everyone's like, I saw you around. It's like I didn't see them.
Yeah.
It's just like a weird phenomenon.
And here's Sam again.
Being able to use a car to make private space in what sort of a public space can have its advantages. Sam will share.
So something that cars are useful for, have been useful for historically, before the gay rights movement, was for gay men to be able to meet up with one another and to turn private or public spaces into private spaces, particularly in places like Flint, Michigan, where there's not a lot of city spaces to gather anonymously. A car could offer a nice opportunity to have some privacy relative to a small town.
I've also been thinking a little bit about people who may be fleeing an intimate partner violence situation, how they would feel. I think they would feel more protected or anonymous if they were in a vehicle where people couldn't see who they were as easily as compared to being on a bicycle where you're more vulnerable, perhaps.
If you're in a car, maybe you can be riding with another person, maybe you have some privacy and you have some more options to move more quickly, and I can imagine that being just a lot safer feeling in terms of opening up some more options and some more physical protection. Like, that is also a physical barrier between you and the world that does have this kind of feeling of being in your own private orb.
Sometimes when I'm feeling emotional, I'm riding my bike, I'm just crying all over town, and whoever I see on the sidewalk, I just got tears streaming down my eyes. But in a car, maybe some people would just pull over and cry.
I think it could be a good idea to pull over, yeah, safety-wise. I know that when I'm biking, if that happens, sometimes I'll blame it on the winter wind. Oh, it's very windy.
So this morning, I was working downtown on my bicycle and for a couple hours during rush hour, and I decided to count the cars and count the bikes.
86. 287, 89, 90, 92, 93, 94, 294. I started counting cars this morning when I left for work, 295. I thought, let's count how many cars and how many cyclists, 296. There are out this morning, 297. And I thought, I wonder how many cars will pass before I see the first cyclist. 298, 299, 300, 301. I'm at 301 and I haven't seen a cyclist yet. 302, 303. I'm right downtown Northampton. At first when I came out, 304, when I came out, I was excited about seeing someone on a bike. And as the cars came and came and came and came, and I still hadn't seen anyone on a bike, then I started to get a little bit discouraged, and then I felt a little overwhelmed, and then I just wanted to cry. Why is it like this? Of these 307, 8, 9, 10 cars that have gone by, how come not a single one of those people could have been on a bicycle? there's only been a very small handful of pedestrians as well. So at first I was sad and demoralized. And then I thought, by gosh, I'm a fighter. I don't care how many cars there are. I'm still going to ride my bike. And each cyclist makes a big difference, at least for my motivation and morale. So 311, 312, 313, 314, 315, 348, 349, 350. Wait, 350 parts per million. That's an important number. 350 cars for no bikes. Hey, you're the first cyclist I've seen. Someone just passed me on a bike. He gave a happy wave as he rode through the light. Woo! We're saved at 354, however many it was. But I think it was a little too late. 601, 602. There goes Art on a bike. A usual suspect. Is there 5, 6, 7, 8? The thing about watching so many cars and trucks go by, it's so demoralizing because I can't see people. I can't see people's faces. I can't see what's inside the boxes, especially with a little rain on the windshield and the so cloudy, so headlights are on. It's just like inhuman. It's just a downtown full of pavement and these giant boxes moving fast. And I know there's human beings, but I can't make eye contact or make a friendly wave unless I really stare and squint. I like it better when people are open and accessible.
Well, if that was demoralizing, now we're going to have a moralizing song. Fats Domino. Fats Domino. You're listening to Out There on Valley View Radio, WXOJLP, Northampton, 103.3 FM, streaming online at valleyfreeradio.org.
For the best in electro, new wave, funk, and dance, tune into Subculture Friday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. Listen from your computer, iPad, or phone by tuning into valleyfreeradio.org. Subculture, Friday nights, here on WXOJ.
So earlier this spring, I went to Mexico City and biked around in there, and I had a different experience of private space, personal space there as compared to here. Here's a little clip.
Estamos en la Avenida de los Insurgentes. I think it's somewhere near downtown. Biking here. Well, yesterday I rode around in a cab for about 2 hours. That was my introduction to the squeezing into any space possibly conceivable. And if you have any chance to go, go, and that being like the rules of the road. And then today we're doing it on a bicycle. Just as long as I know I'm not being rude. It's okay. I think I'm used to there being like 3 feet of personal space. But it seems like here the personal space is about 3 inches or less, depending on if you're going slower. But it's great. I'm really glad I have someone to follow.
All right. The next interview I have is with Colby Singleton, also one of my coworkers, a lot about how she learned to become a bike mechanic.
Colby, what got you into biking, or how did you start?
I got my first bike in college, and it was a 3-speed cruiser, and I started just riding around campus, the 1-mile campus, going very short distances. My first big ride, according to me, was I finally made it to Child's Park from Smith Campus, which, again, is about half a mile one way. That was a big deal when I rode it that far out. And over the course of a year or two, I started riding it to Amherst to go to when I was taking classes at other colleges. And I would just go for rides for fun to East Hampton and up towards Leeds. And eventually, I decided to go on a big adventure, and I decided to ride to Poughkeepsie, which is... It was, I think, about 80 or 100 miles, and I decided to do it in 2 days, and I had never ridden farther than about 5 miles at a time. I didn't know anything about repairs or anything mechanical, didn't even know how to fix a flat, but I crossed my fingers, and I mounted a wicker basket onto the front handlebars with a wire coat hanger, and I stuffed my sleeping bag in there, and I put on my backpack with a couple of water bottles in it, and I was off.
By yourself?
By myself. Mm-hmm. I had my printed out map and I think some directions. I went as far as I could the first day. I think I probably went about 50 miles the first day and just found a place to camp along the way. There were times when I felt kind of nervous and was wondering if it was a really bad idea. Yeah, I kind of had no idea what I was getting myself into, but especially towards the end and once I got there, I felt really accomplished. Like, wow, I've never gone this far on my own. Yeah, like, wow, if I have this much determination to do something like this, like, what else can I do?
Do you remember any fears that you had to overcome to go on this trip?
Well, definitely other people's fears were a big thing. Other people were really nervous, and people tried to persuade me not to go. People were worried because I didn't really know how to solve any problems if anything came up on my bike, which is a valid fear, I should say.
So you've learned a lot about fixing bikes since then. How have you educated yourself?
Well, that trip sort of made me realize I got really lucky that I went that far. I didn't even get one single flat. So I thought I should probably not try my luck again in the same way. So I joined the student organization at Smith College for bike repairs. That was the first space that sort of the option was there for me to learn about bikes and about bike mechanics.
It just wasn't something you were exposed to growing up.
Yeah, definitely not with bicycles. I never really considered it an option until college.
What was the bike kitchen like for you when you first started going there?
Well, it was a small group of women who were all excited about riding bikes, and we would all just kind of go and hang out and maybe put a bike on a stand every once in a while. When I first joined, I was just so excited to be there. I found whatever I could do to be involved, and that started with just sort of organizing nuts and bolts and organizing little pieces of things that I could identify. One of the first summers after I joined the organization, there were no other students who were going to stick around over the summer. I was the only student involved with the Bike Kitchen who was going to be in Northampton over the summer. And we do a summer rental program, so renting out a fleet of bikes to students who are on campus over the summer. So I agreed to do that, and that was the first real leadership experience that I had there and where I took on responsibility. So it was up to me to make sure that the bikes were safe to be rented out. And at the time, I had no idea how to make that happen. So I invited a couple of friends of mine that I knew from elsewhere to come over and help me. It was a daunting task, and I'm sure it didn't actually go that well, but it was a great opportunity to have that leadership.
So when did the Bike Kitchen start, and when did you become involved?
It started in 2005. A student started it on her own. I joined in 2008. I think it might have been the next year. I really felt like I wanted to keep learning in a more structured way. So that was the summer that I used this internship program that Smith offers over the summer to work at the Bike Lab with you, Ruthie. I went to Bike Lab every Saturday pretty much for that summer and just observed you teaching people and like learned a lot about both the mechanical side of things and how to teach mechanics. So that was definitely the next step for learning more. And towards the end of the summer, I started guiding people through things at Bike Lab, and there might have been one or two weekends that you were away, and I was so nervous to run the Bike Lab without you, but I did it.
Thank you.
Then a little while later, I still felt like I really wanted to learn more. So I applied for a program through Bikes Not Bombs in Boston. They do a number of educational bike programs, and one that they do is called Vocational Education Training, and it's a 90-hour course that they offer for people who are interested in working in bike shops. I got into the class, and I commuted to Boston once a week for the class and stayed there a couple nights and then would come back to Northampton and work. I took the bus. My confidence was much, much, much increased after that course. So much so that I went around to almost every bike shop in the area and tried to get a job, and went to some bike shops a couple of times. And after going to the Hampshire Bike Exchange about 5 or 6 times asking for a job, the owner asked me if I was available right then and there to stay for the rest of the day. I said, sure. I worked on a couple bikes for the afternoon, and then he asked me when I could come back next. So it took a lot of persistence, but I definitely was able to pursue that job with the new confidence that I had from that course.
When you were going around to bike shops asking for jobs, did you see other women mechanics there?
No, I didn't see any other female mechanics. I personally have never seen another female mechanic in a bike shop in the valley. That might just be me. I know that a couple of women work doing other jobs in bike shops around here, but yeah, I think women mechanics are pretty rare, at least here.
How do you think the lack of female mechanics has affected you trying to get a job at a bike shop and being a female mechanic?
It feels like it was harder to get a job. I'm not sure what other mechanics' experiences are getting jobs, but it felt like I really had to prove myself to even be considered. I mean, one thing is it has kind of fueled my determination over time. At this point, I'm really passionate about mechanics. I love bike mechanics, and just kind of getting to show myself in that way to people over and over who, whether they show it or not, I think are surprised is a really satisfying thing. On the other hand, I doubt myself a lot doing the work, and there's kind of always this standard that I'm holding myself to, or this assumption that my coworkers are doing the job, my male coworkers are doing the job better than I am, more thoroughly than I am, and I kind of always feel like lesser than, or like not quite as good as them. And in terms of learning mechanics, working at a bike shop is a great place to learn about bike mechanics. For one, just doing anything 8 hours a day makes you a whole lot better at it. Secondly, working alongside people who do have, you know, some amount of more experience than I do is really great. When I have questions, there are people who I can ask.
I know you've taught some classes at the bike kitchen. Is that a direction that you want to continue to move in?
Yeah, I definitely love teaching mechanics almost as much as I love doing mechanics myself. Mm-hmm. As a woman, teaching mechanics to other women feels like a really powerful thing. I feel like I get to be a role model. The process of learning bike mechanics has really opened my eyes to what else is possible for me to learn and to get good at. I have a lot more confidence with just like the physical world in general and kind of the process of figuring things out. Whereas before, I kind of just assumed that was somebody else's job and not really available to me to use my mind in that way. I definitely have developed a lot more confidence in my life in general, thanks to the specific practice of bike mechanics.
So you're going to bike mechanics school, like another bike mechanic class school soon too, right?
So it's been long enough that I'm ready again for another round of structured learning. So I'm going to do a 2-week advanced mechanics program. The class is called Bicycle Repair and Overhaul, the acronym for which would be BRO. I'm going all the way to Colorado for this. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm excited to be there to learn efficient ways of doing things that I already know how to do, plus some more mechanical things that I'm still kind of in the dark about. And I'm also really curious to see what their teaching style is like. It's really hard to learn mechanical things just by watching other people. So get yourself in there. Push the teacher away if you have to. Get your own hands on the project, because just getting the feel of it is a huge part of the process, and there's no way you can get the feel of it in your hands if you're just watching someone else do the work. When I'm teaching at the bike kitchen, I sort of try to get a feel for how hands-on the people who I'm working with want to be. And usually I will demonstrate something myself first and then undo it and let them do it themselves, unless they seem really disinterested. And then I'll just kind of demonstrate and explain what I'm doing along the way and leave the instruction at that. One day, my own assumptions and expectations about people were highlighted when this very feminine woman walked in with her bike. She was all dressed up, I think wearing high heels, and I guess I had a lot of expectations about what kind of mechanic she would be, which were definitely defied when she didn't even want to demonstration. She wanted to do everything herself. She hardly even wanted explanations, although she did stick around for that part too. But that was just good for me to be reminded that you really don't know what people are like. People with all sorts of gender expressions are capable of all sorts of things.
That was Colby Singleton, an anchor of the Smith College Bike Kitchen. Dwayne, Colby mentioned the bike lab a few times. Do you want to say a word about that?
Absolutely. It's a bike lab at 12 Northern Avenue in Northampton, Mass. Every Saturday from 11 o'clock till 2 o'clock, free bike help. I've been there for 3.5-4 years, and you've been doing it for, what, 10?
Something like that. Yeah, so come on over any Saturday. We also sometimes sell some used bikes.
Cheap.
And if they come with a guarantee, come back any Saturday from 11 to 2 and we'll help you fix it.
They come with a guarantee to the end of the driveway.
So it's actually Page depaved, so there's not even a driveway. Well, you've been listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. I actually have one more little clip. Sometimes I get thoughts when I'm riding on the bike path at night or scootering on the bike path at night, and here's my thought of the night from this week.
I want to say something about the use of the word dark, as in, when I read the news, it took me to a dark place. For me, I love the darkness. I'm often in search of natural darkness, but I can't find any anymore. The darkness is precious. It's a soft, warm, comforting place. Like sleeping, it's just cozy and I feel protected and have positive connotations with it. So when you use the word dark to mean something negative, maybe think about what specifically you mean and think about other descriptive words like macabre or negative or sad, depressed, scary. But the word dark, it's a neutral word. And to regularly link it with negative connotations doesn't do anything to help us overcome our negative stereotypes of people that we label dark.
Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Up at 5 o'clock. This is Dave Rovics with the Bicycle Song.
Everybody's wondering what they're gonna do. Everything's a mess and folks are feeling blue. If your troubles got you down so much you can't abide, get on that bicycle and ride. Yeah, get on that bicycle and ride. Neath the sunny skies or along the ocean side, just ride, 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 ride. They're doing it in Eugene, Havana, and Shanghai. Even folks in Boston town are giving it a try, throwing out their gas tanks, the clean air by their side. Just get on that bicycle and ride. Yeah, get on that bicycle and ride. Neath the sunny skies or along the ocean side, just ride, 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 ride. It's good for your heart and it's good for your brain. When those fluorescent lights are driving you insane, your toes will tingle in your shoes when to the pedal they reply. Just get on that bicycle and ride. Yeah, get on that bicycle and ride. Neath the sunny skies or along the ocean side, just ride, ride, ride. You're having troubles with your lovers, the tandem's made for that. You'll work together wonderfully, or else you'll just go splat. Gonna shut down Main Street, make the bike paths far and wide, and get on that bicycle and ride. Yeah, get on that bicycle and ride. Neath the sunny skies or along the ocean side, just ride, ride, ride.
You are listening to Democracy Now! On Valley Free Radio 103.3 WXOJ LP Northampton.